Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Sharek Shaikh, CEO of CleverX.
Finding a specific set of customer is really, really valuable rather than trying to go after five different people, because your product can serve five people. It's not like it won't. But where does it like really solve a pain where people are excited, like ready to give you the money right away? That is what you should be looking for.
This is Sharek. He's a two-time founder in the human capital and the future of workspace. He has successfully created businesses that have generated multi-million dollars in sale. Sharek's story is about an immigrant's Silicon Valley dream. He has lived and worked in four different countries and traveled to over 35 countries. He spends most of his time understanding how people collaborate and share knowledge in different contexts of work. Before becoming a tech entrepreneur, Sharek worked at Gartner. He helped them build programs so technology leaders across industries could collaborate with each other in a trusted space. The challenges he had to overcome in that period inspired him to found CleverX in January of 2020. Their mission? To make human knowledge accessible to all and be your trusted place to build real relationships and get work done. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Sharek to my podcast. We explore the journey of building a solution for the broken B2B market in commercial research. Sharek digs into the critical choices he made early on and explains his first principles for creating a SaaS business that people find worth making a remark about. He shares his views on avoiding dependence on venture capital and getting pricing right from the start. And last but not least, he shares what it takes to navigate various companies' phases successfully. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, why he doesn't believe in minimum viable product and what he did instead to drive success early on in the process. Secondly, why he'd explore more verticals at the same time if he'd ever get a chance. Thirdly, how he is testing whether he's on the right track with his product fit and strategy. And lastly, what he's doing differently to get feedback that translates directly into his development choices. Well, hi Sharek. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Don. Yeah.
And when I got introduced to your company, and of course, I always do my research and I figure out, like, is this going to be a nice fit? Does it fit the purpose of the podcast? And when, what are the big learnings that we can have here? And I think we are going to come up for a very interesting story based on what we have discussed so far. But before we go into your company, CleverX,
yeah,
first a little bit about you. What drives you? Where do you get energy from?
Yeah, I think my personal startups are a means to an end for me. I mean, I love what I do, don't get me wrong. But I think, you know, I want to build something philanthropical, you know, at a scale on the causes that I care about. And every time I go down, because the startup journey is so like, it has so many ups and downs, that is the thing that pulls me. So I think that's the reason for my drive. But of course, I love building things and building companies, which is one of the most exciting jobs I think you can have. It's a expression of, you know, your thoughts or visions, and you're building something which was once just a thought and you made it a reality. So that's amazing, right? You know, so I think this whole idea of creating and building things is something I love. But at the end of the day, you want to do something, you want good things to come out of it before you leave the world. So hopefully that's what the plan is, and hopefully I'll be able to achieve that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're starting companies on a regular basis. I've recently seen that you also started a company called Reflow. We're going to talk about CleverX, but that proves again that there's an entrepreneurial spirit here. So when you started CleverX in back in 2020,
yep,
which was COVID year, what was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution like yours?
Yeah, so just to give you a bit of a context, right, and take you back a few years, my background has been in technology. I'm a software engineer by trade, you know, did that back in India from a pretty good engineering school. And I got to work with a lot of companies, including Microsoft, SAP, Oracle on in the enterprise space. Before starting CleverX, I worked with Gartner Research, which is the world's largest technology research company. Fascinating bunch of people. You work with really, really smart people there. And I realized that the market research space, especially in the B2B world, which is a commercial research work, is very broken when it comes to online surveys and research interviews. And what I mean by being broken is there's a lot of fraud that happens in this industry, close to around 40% when an online survey project happens. A lot of people don't know this, but that's like a standard in that industry. And it happens because of trust and transparency issues. So even though if you're a researcher and you're paying $1 million to conduct like an online survey with like the top leaders in SMB in the US, you don't know who these people are who've taken up your survey most of the times, like 99% of the times, because the way this whole industry is structured is based on this blinded data, and it creates a lot of conflict of interest between different parties who are running the project. And I think that's something that I saw while, you know, taking up this journey. And it's a huge market. It's like $55 billion worth of spent only in the US on online surveys, both B2B and B2C. And we wanted to fix that. So we came up with a solution that the product has to look like a professional network. So our platform actually looks very much like any professional network, like a LinkedIn, where you can search people, connect with them. But it also comes with these tools that you can integrate with your audience. And you can conduct surveys with known people even before you start your project. So I will know as a researcher, I can be confident that the people who have taken part into my survey, I know them individually, I can connect with them, I can chat with them. But at the same time, I'm very confident in my insights, because even if someone does a project which is like $100,000, the impact of that outcome is in millions of dollars. They're making major business decision based on that. And if you don't know who's taken up your survey, the whole thing falls apart in my view.
Yeah.
So we've come up with this novel way of doing things now. And I believe that's going to be the future of this industry. Companies which are going to rely on transparency and trust will have better outcomes than the ones who don't.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm involved in a couple of those research organizations. And I mean, the number of questions that I have to answer prior to even answering the real question, sometimes it's
insane. Yeah.
It's insane. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, and I completely, it brings back memories. I mean, I've been working with Gartner for a long time in my role when I was heading up product marketing and product management at Unit 4. One of my side things was also analyst relationships. So, I've been to their offices, I bought their research, and I didn't know about the 40% fraud.
That's the overall industry average, by the way. You know, any project, it's because when you go to a market research company or an agency and ask them, like, who are my responders, they can tell you that these are people who are CIOs or head of products, you know?
Yeah.
But they can't individually tell you who these people are. What that tells you is like probably they don't even know who these people are. So there are black markets right now in the world where people's full-time job is to take surveys on behalf of execs just by claiming wrong information. Because online surveys in B2B can range from like $75 to even $200 per successful response. If you take that number in a developing country, that's a pretty big number where if you take 5 surveys in a month, you can still live a good life. It's insane, right? Like, so there's these conflict of interest that's going on in that space. And I think that can only be resolved with like transparency.
Exactly. So that's how it started. You started building. What is the opportunity if you get this right? You know, how will it transform the industry? I mean, I believe as well that transparency and trust is the foundation of that all.
Right.
What will happen?
I think what will happen is the biggest thing that we want to make happen as a mission, as a startup, and I think everyone in my team knows this, we want to change the status quo of what's going on. Money is a byproduct of that. So, you know, that's great. Like, you know, you can be $1 billion-plus company, you know, you can be a unicorn and all that. But I think what we want to do is change the way things are done forever, because this industry hasn't changed for the last 30 years. There hasn't been a new way to do it. If we are that company, or even anyone else comes up with that approach and does this job, that will change the status quo of the industry. And that's a really powerful thing. And then things would be standardized to that level. And that's a pretty good thing, because then you're adding like this confidence to a market researcher's job, because they don't feel that confident when they're doing things in a traditional way.
Exactly. Yeah, that's. I mean, I like your approach. Focus on the success you help your customers create, rather than what's going to be your potential exit yourself. Because it's as long as the value is with the customer and you keep improving that, that other value will come your way one way or the other, which you're going to want to talk about in a minute, because of the of how you got to build a company right now. So going back to that journey, and you know, you start, you can choose any type of technology. What has been a fundamental choice that you've made early on that is really helping with the success that you have today?
I think it was a very contrarian view that I took, which always is a debate with other fellow founders on the idea of minimum viable product.
Uh-huh.
So that's a very interesting thing to talk about. I think very opposite to most of the people. I do not believe in MVPs, for a simple reason that the definition of MVP that you have in your head as a founder is most likely very different than the definition of MVP that your customer has. If you're not sure about those two things, I don't think you should approach it as an MVP. Like, your job is to build. And I see that quite often where people are like, oh, I built the MVP, it didn't work out, the customers, there's no need in the market. No, that's not true. You build an MVP that you thought was an MVP, the customer was expecting something else, or the outcome of the product or the value to come out of it in a certain way. So even if you build an MVP, it's not a bad market. You just chose the wrong approach. You didn't give them the value that they expected. So I think that's where a lot of people make a mistake in terms of choosing the approach, how to build a product. So we were very diligent about that fact. We kept building the product, which could scale, and it helped us. You know, we didn't have to do a lot of re-engineering every few months, because we were building. We knew that what our goal was. We knew there is a market out there, and we built the product thinking about scale from the beginning, which is very contrary to Silicon Valley thought process.
Yeah, true.
But that's totally okay. You know, everyone has their own ways of doing it, but we did things differently, which worked out for us.
I mean, for every type of product, there's of course a golden set of rules or a framework. And I mean, I've also read the Lean Startup, and I mean, they advise to go to the minimum viable product. I also, by the way, completely agree with you that minimum viable product is completely the wrong name for it. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, for certain products, there needs to be a different type of approach. What I've come to love about the phrase, and to turn it around, is things like minimum lovable product, or something at the end that takes the customer into account. Because if it's minimum viable, it runs. It doesn't crash.
It runs, it doesn't crash, and you don't even know what does viable mean. These are all minimum and viable, both are subjective terms. Like, then why minimum and why viability as a founder, or is it as a customer's minimum viability, right?
Yeah.
So it's, when you compare two subjective things, it's very difficult to, and on top of it, products are subjective, right?
Exactly.
So it's an approach I try to keep myself away from. I'm okay to get more engineering debt rather than getting a false understanding of a market. I would choose that as a trade-off. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, completely agree. So what happened then? You know, you chose not to go the MVP route. You chose to go to, potentially the minimum lovable product, to build something that's valuable to customers. And in the meantime, you know, it was 3 years down the road. You've passed 1 million ARR. You're profitable. What has been the biggest positive learning in that space? Or in that in that process?
I think the biggest, it was also a failure on my part in the first year. What we did was, when we were talking to people while we're building the product, just trying to understand what do they care about, right? What is the value that they want to get from a platform like that? The mistake I made at the time was, we went deeper into a vertical to check with people like, hey, you need this and that. I think we should have done multiple verticals testing at the same time. We stumbled upon our first customer that just went really, you know, crazy when they saw what we were building. And before that, we just couldn't find that like intense, you know, feedback from there and like, hey, I just love what you guys are building. This is going to solve so many problems for me in the previous verticals that we were testing. So I think testing different verticals or personas simultaneously will save a lot of time. That was my learning, but we were lucky, right? We found that customer and then we just kept repeating with the same set of customers. And that's the majority of our revenue coming from those 99% of the customers. The learning is try to build a product or where you are not replaceable with any other company or a product. At least you're very highly differentiated. The second important thing is your customers, your existing customers are using you more frequently every few months or every quarter. So their usage has to increase. That is one of the biggest signs of product market fit. It's not like the first buy. It's actually the first buy and then the repeatability, right? That's what product market fit means. So we became a company where customers would sign up, use us, and then they kept increasing the share of wallet on the platform. Today, we have customers who even spend like $500,000 a year on a platform. So it's pretty exciting to see that happen. So that's been a pretty good learning of how you constantly keep improving to make your value more deeper into their world. But finding a specific set of customer is really, really valuable rather than trying to go after five different people, because your product can serve five people. It's not like it won't. But where does it like really solve a pain where people are excited, like ready to give you the money right away? That is what you should be looking for.
Let me make a small interruption here. Sharek just made an excellent remark that explains how he has built a strong foundation for success in his company. Acknowledge you cannot please everyone. It might very well be that you can help a lot of people functionality-wise, but not all of them will put the same face value on your solution. Search for the ones where you solve a mission-critical problem is the answer. And that's exactly what Sharek has done. This accelerates sales, it increases win rates, and it makes the word discount disappear. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. Sharply define who you're for and who you're not for. Clarify how you're solving the most important problem differently and articulate what impacts that creates, i.e. offer something valuable and desirable. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking to the converted. Have you got any ground rule that you use to identify that or to make decisions left or right?
Yeah, it is a confusing time, right? Like when you speak to people, the ground rule is charge money from day one, because money is the validator that your product, at least at the initial, the promise is working for the customer, which means that a lot of founders, and I know my personally, like friends, you know, in Silicon Valley or outside, they think getting feedback from a person means validation, because people are nice in general. People are really nice people. Like they want to tell you things that would make you feel comfortable. But if you ask the same person to take out their wallet and put their credit card to use your product, almost 90% of the people or even 99% of the people will disappear after that conversation. So getting money in, especially in that B2B space, is really, really important from day one. And I think we were very conscious about that fact, because that's a good validation. Like I'm paying you money. That means I care about what you're building and it might help me solve a certain problem with my work. I always tell this to founders, like sell and see how you, if someone's buying the product, that's a good validation. If they're just saying like, yeah, I would buy it, you know, that's great. This looks amazing. I've never seen something like that. That means nothing. It has really no value because they're not putting their money where the mouth is, right? So it is really, really important for founders to charge, even if it's like a small value, to validate the need exists.
Yeah, exactly. You made an interesting point about not being replaceable, having distinct differentiation, defensible differentiation. I mean, the market for research type tools is not new, you know? There's been vendors around. I had a couple of my podcasts actually over the last couple of years. So how What have you focused on in order to build a defensible differentiation?
I think the hardest thing, just to give you a bit of a context on how large online survey projects work. So if you're spending $100,000 on an online survey project, almost 70% of that money goes to incentivizing your respondents or recruiting them. That's the majority chunk of the project. The other 30% would go on subscription for Qualtrics or the tool that you're using for creating the survey, programming the survey, or even writing down the report that you provide to your final customer, right? But the 70% of the chunk actually goes to recruiting and incentivizing these respondents. And that is a broken piece. So we want to come into that 70% where we want to give you access, instant access to the most relevant people for that particular online survey or research study, and give you also the ability to interact with them, connect with them transparently, make sure there is no fraud, and also the ability to pay out incentives through our platform. So that is a piece we are trying to go after, which is the 70% chunk of an online survey project.
Yeah.
And that is one of the most important determinant factor for a success of an online survey. So it becomes really, really important for a customer. If your respondents are not great, like your outcome is not going to be great, you might create the best online survey on Qualtrics. Doesn't matter.
Yeah,
the best questions, it doesn't matter. Because the most important determinant is the quality of your respondents.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You've taken a different approach in order to kind of get that certainty on quality of people.
Yeah, it's a quality is the idea of instantly connecting with these respondents, because there are a lot of like unreliable panels in the research process and they take time. It's not just like they're unreliable. They're also like time consuming. You have to interact with people on emails. And on top of that, they're not going to tell you who your respondents are. So it's like a no brainer, you know, for a customer. If I can start my project like right now using CleverX, why wouldn't I do that with 100% transparency? And I know exactly whom I'm going to be interacting with or whose insight I'm taking into my project. So it's a win-win for the customer and in terms of time saving and quality as well.
Yeah. Yeah, very important. I mean, I like the fact that you made that point, because at the end, you know, everybody can build a survey type of functionality. I mean, SurveyMonkey has one.
Yeah.
Doesn't make them a good tool for the type of problems that a number of companies try to solve. I mean, that goes back to like your vertical and solving a particular highly valuable and critical problem to them.
Right.
Because the bulk of the market, a big portion of the market, can go to tools like the Survey Monkeys because you want to do a piece of survey.
Yeah.
But for others, of course, that's a different ballgame. So it all depends. And that's why product marketing is so fascinating and why there is room for pretty much everybody to just take and own a particular piece of the market.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. So you mentioned that you started, you were lucky to find a vertical whereby you instantly stumbled across a highly valuable and critical problem that you could solve like no one else. So customer one came, customer two came, and you've mentioned prior to our starting that you got around 16,000 users right now.
Yeah.
What has been the most difficult and on that journey to grow it to that 16,000 user mark?
Yeah, it's a pretty good question. I think about it all the time. It's the idea of running a marketplace as a business in general, which means like you have two sides of businesses that you have to work in parallel and balance that out. And growing the supply side as the demand comes, growing the demand side as the supply side comes, because if either of the party doesn't get the transaction done, they will leave and the other one will leave after them. So constantly growing them into balance and connecting these defragmented, you know, parts of the marketplace is the most challenging thing, I believe. But the fun part also is doing it, because marketplaces are the most resilient type of businesses. Once they have this liquidity and then they are working really well, they're very difficult to kill, or, you know, they're very highly defensible. Like take examples of the Amazons of the world or Ubers, Airbnbs. But taking them from like 0 to 1 is the most difficult thing, getting that initial liquidity. But I think we are getting there, you know, and we're scaling now. So that balancing act has been the most difficult one. You're almost running two businesses at the same time when you're doing marketplace. Yeah,
true. Because two sides of messages, I mean, one message to the one person, the other one couldn't care less. So how did you balance that? How did you find that early traction?
Yeah, I think what we did was we went to the demand side first and tried to understand what do they care about, what kind of people they want to see on the marketplace. And we promise them, like, if you get those people, would you be willing to like try it out for us, right? And they're like, yeah, that's okay. Because nobody wants to walk into a store where there's no product, right? Yep. And then when we knew that the demand cared about these specific one or two verticals, so we only chose one or two verticals that we wanted to go after, we almost hustled our way. The first 1,000 users on the platform were onboarded personally by me. So I almost convinced people, like over email, sometimes I had to jump on Zoom calls. I don't know how many Zoom calls I've done, like 15, 20 minute Zoom calls to convince people to sign up on the platform. And these are all senior business professionals, right? Cleverx is not like a B2C research platform. It's a B2B. That means these people are manager about in large, small companies, entrepreneurs, C-level execs in public listed companies. So there's some very valuable people on the platform. They have very low temperament. Like, why would they care about like the startup founder who's building this, right? So it was hustle for sure. But when we got like the first 100, 200 users and gave them the opportunity to participate in research, made an experience really easy for on them about getting paid by just participating in research projects, they started bringing other people as well. So now it's almost like, you know, people actually are happy to invite their friends to participate on the platform. And if you go on the platform today, you have a public page, which is called as Opportunities, and you can see almost right now 60 or 70 projects live that you can participate as a user into different research projects. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's of course the first part to get through that minimum viable audience almost. Yeah, and of course it comes from your network, but at the end you got it right. You know, you're not talking about consumers that you ask for ranking a headset or something like that. It's about completely different things.
Yeah, it's like asking about pricing for enterprise software products, or like how does the business macro trend look like in the US because you're the CEO of an SMB. Yeah, very different questions altogether. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Any particular mistake that you said, okay, I hope I never make that again?
I think hiring the right people is the most important thing to do. I made mistakes in hiring wrong people as well, but I don't know how much can I blame myself to do that, because interview process is like, it's not easy to gauge people in a few hours. So that's one. The second is letting people go quickly as well, because as a startup founder, at least in the initial days, early employees don't understand that how much you value your early employees, because they're believing in your company and your mission and needing like a job at Meta or Apple or Google to join your company.
That's true. Yeah.
So letting them go becomes really difficult as well. And I think you learn along the way over the years. But initially, that was really difficult for me to have those conversations and letting people go. Am I making a mistake about letting this person go, or should I let them go? I think letting them go earlier, or having at least those discussions about performance, is something I used to shy about. I don't do that anymore, but that's something that I learned along the way. I think everyone goes through that. Yeah. So yeah, hiring the right people and letting people go, or at least having conversation if their performance is not good early on, is better.
Yeah, exactly. The point that you make is a great one in general for startup business, but in that process of growing towards the 16,000 users, was there any mistake that was painful, but we can all learn from?
We have pain every single day. Don't get me wrong. Like there's pain every single day, right? It just as you grow, pains change. Literally, this is the exact conversation I had with the team.
Yeah.
On Friday, we had like a team call, and I was telling this to the entire team that now we're growing and we're going to face different problems. So stop getting overwhelmed. Every new milestone that you hit, you're going to face very different problems, and we should be mentally at least be aware of it. So pain is always going to be there in this journey. It's inevitable. But I think for us, as we scaled, more people, the percentage of people remain the same who were probably happy or not happy with the product. The number increases, right, with scale. And then taking care of those things was difficult. So we made a couple of mistakes which affected our users in the process. And we had to quickly revert to things which were like before, especially when it came to like incentivization and how our users used to take the money out of the platform. And money is like a really, really important thing, which means like you can get upset very quickly if there are issues around money. So we had to work with another vendor, fix that problem as we were scaling. So those times were fun. But I think these things happen as you grow. You know, of course, you don't want them to happen. You don't want people to get affected while you're working or they're using your product. But it's inevitable, you know, as you scale, you're going to have those problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's you touched upon a very important topic because the moment you go and cross that 1 million and you go to grow to the next couple of millions there, inevitably, of course, you need to hire more people. And with more people comes more complexity and all of those type of things. You mentioned also that you've become profitable in the meantime.
Yeah.
And one of the things you said early on was, okay, one thing to validate whether you're actually doing something that's valuable is getting people to pay. So how important is your pricing strategy for you? How important has it been to get profitable because of that?
Yeah, I think I have a different outlook towards profitability and raising money. What I mean by that is we will never go out to raise money as a company. That's our general, you know, philosophy in the company.
Yeah.
We don't believe in like having not profitability and going out to raise money. Because what if you're not able to raise money? What if, you know, you're pressured into taking the terms that you're going to like regret for the rest of your life? We don't want to be in that position. So we want our customers to fund us, which has happened with us, which we're very lucky and grateful for. But that's the philosophy that we have generally in the team. Like keep the burn low, you know, be profitable from your customers, and then you go out and raise money. That's number one, the underlying philosophy of how we see money. On the pricing side, I think companies should test out different pricing models as early as possible, because sometimes your product could be good enough for someone to buy, but pricing could be a problem. Like in our industry, a lot of people hate subscription, and I understand why. The reason they hate subscription, like SaaS models, is because their work is very seasonal. So when their work is seasonal, when they earn money seasonally, they can't give you like commitment over the year that I'm going to spend this much on every month on the subscription. So founders need to understand that. And they should not get pressured by their investors and VCs, because VCs mark up more money on SaaS products, right? And they will force the founder to choose a SaaS model. And I've seen companies failing just because of bad pricing structure. The company was great. People were amazing. The product was amazing. It was solving a problem. The moment the company switched from transaction to subscription, because they were kind of forced to increase their valuation or their multiple, right? The customer didn't want to buy it. The customer was like, I'm not going to commit to a year for this because my business is not committed to me. Like the market is not committed to me. So I think keeping that in mind is so important. So we have some customers who are subscription customers because they care about subscription. They're okay with subscription having more discounted on usage on the product. But there are some customers who want to use it transactionally. And some transaction customers actually pay way more than subscription customers, but they want that freedom. They don't want to be locked in, right?
Yeah.
And I love those customers because they keep us on our toes as well to build the product like the best way possible. So we keep them with us without that monthly subscription commitment. But your founders should be very, very careful about how you price it. Just don't go by SaaS because SaaS is easier to raise money, or it is, you know, your valuation is 10x or 20x because it's a SaaS. At the end of the day, you're serving your customer base. You should care about what they care about. It doesn't matter what your VC investors tell you. You should take their advice. I'm sure they know a lot of stuff that you don't know. But at the end, your customer should be the one dictating what your pricing is and your economics should look like.
Okay.
The market always validates a company. Yeah. It was a simple interview. Like I remember 20 years back, you know, Jeff Bezos was getting interviewed and the reporter kept pressing him, are you an online business or are you an offline business? He's like, it doesn't matter. I want the product to reach to my customer, be it through online, physical, whatever ways. What matters is the customer gets the product to their home without any hassle. We are customer obsessed. We are not obsessed if we are an online company or we are not. And the reporter kept pressing him. As an old interview, it's very fascinating to watch that. I think that's the philosophy you should have about thinking for your customer rather than anyone else.
Exactly.
Everyone's got their own incentives to look at, right? So
yeah,
you should care about customer incentives the most, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, what about a great product, great people, and so on, and the customers don't want to buy because of, you know, the metrics are
pricing model. Yeah,
exactly. Now, talking about that, you know, building a fan base, building customer base that keeps coming back for more. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect. So I'm fascinated by just that thought. How are you steering the company in order to achieve that, to create a business that your customers start talking about and keep talking about?
Yeah, we are actually we're already in a position where we get a lot of referrals from our existing customers without us asking, which is how it should be, because they're happy with what we have built for them and they're getting the value every single day, every single week when they use our product. I think the idea is to constantly have conversations with your existing customers and keep asking them, what are the three things that you like about what you do with our platform and the three worst things as well? A lot of people shy away from asking their potential customer or their most existing customer, what is ugly about my baby, you know? And if you get that answer, and some customers who care about your company will give you that answer because they want you to improve, because they're spending money on you. They want to fix those problems. Just getting that information and see a trend of like these two, three things everyone's talking about, that should be the top priority of your company to work with. So we do that every month almost. Like personally, I travel or I'll talk to my customers on Zoom calls to get that input. It helps us a lot in terms of building the product in the right direction that they care about the most.
Exactly. Yeah. It keeps yourself honest.
Yeah. They also feel valued, right? Like, oh, this guy's coming to me to ask for my feedback. I matter to them. And when they remember you that way, when someone is talking to them about that same problem that you're fixing, they'll be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to connect you to CleverX or Shari. I know those guys. They're good people. They're always asking for better feedback. They're always trying to improve. You don't have to be perfect to get that referral. You just have to be seen as a company that cares about what they think.
Yeah, true. I think that's the right word, the word care. Okay, well, last question, because I'm looking at the time as well. Based on your journey over the last couple of years, being the founder of a number of SaaS companies, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with the audience, with peer tech CEOs, things that you loved to have known before?
Yeah, I think the do's would be get in front of your customer, potential customer, as early as possible. Don't waste your time on thinking about the name of the company, the website, design so much. I mean, have a decent looking company brand or whatever, but try to get in front of your users and customers to find out your assumption is about that problem. Is it correct or not? Sometimes we think we know a lot, we don't. And your job is to validate through first principles if that's the truth or not. I mean, you should have your belief and be delusional as a founder. Don't get me wrong, you need that. But you also need a balancing act to know, like, does your customer base also think that way, or your user base also thinks that way? So quickly getting to that validation is the most important thing. And then you give them a product that will solve that problem without too many hassles or issues. I think that would be the dose. The second one would be constantly keep talking to people. Like even today, we talk to people, although like we've crossed a decent milestone, but we still talk to our customer base. And that is a consistent thing. It shouldn't be a part of your first, journey as a founder. It should be a consistent thing. Third thing is hire the best people that you can, not just from a skill set standpoint, who are culturally the right fit for your company. I would give up on skill sets by 20% for the right culture fit. I'm totally okay, because people can learn. You cannot change their personality. So it's better to give them the ability to learn and the skills and the training, but you can't change anyone's personality. It's not your job as well as a founder. You just want to have the people who think like you to be a part of the company. So it's one of the most important things is culture that I think tech companies at least should care about, because your product is a reflection of the team. It's not, anything else. It's
point,
a bunch of people with a laptop, right? That's what the input is.
Exactly.
The output is a product, right? So if they are not a good fit with each other and with your values, don't hire them. They could be the best people in the world. Please don't do that. Like, okay to discount on skills a little bit. The other thing that would be the do's would be like choose your investors correctly. We were very lucky. We have incredible investors, super helpful, amazing people that I wouldn't change anyone. But I know a lot of people who have taken companies to New York Stock Exchange as public, and the biggest regret they had was choosing the wrong investors. They made their life miserable and horrible. So just don't take money for the sake of taking money. Like, choose who you want to work with for the next 5 to 10 years. Exactly. If you're going to choose a bad relationship, it's going to mess up your company, your physical, mental health. is just a bad, bad decision. It's, that money is not worth it, even if it's millions of dollars. So that is another small thing that I would like suggest to people. Yeah.
Wise advice. And I like the way you talked about, you know, your product is the sum of the culture of your company. And that's so true. You can have 10, 20 competitors that build exactly the same functionality, but it's indeed those people with that laptop, with their minds, that build something in a different way, and that helps you stand out. Yep. That's so true. So where can people go and find out more about CleverX or to say hi to you?
Yeah, they can simply sign up on the platform. I suggest all of your audiences, you know, anyone who's listening to this podcast, sign up on CleverX and see for opportunities in market research that you can do it. So it's CleverX.com. And you can reach out to me, you know, on LinkedIn. That's the only social media channel that I use, and Twitter, I think. But LinkedIn would be the best way to reach out to me with my name, S-H-A-I-K-H. S-H-A-I-K-H. So I think I should come up on the search, and I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone would want to discuss anything. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. This is really helpful. Fun to talk and listen to like the journey that you've been through and the lessons that you've learned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. Really appreciate being here.
And this ends my conversation with Sharak, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspires you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Sharak Shaikh, founder and CEO of CleverX. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.